Okay, everyone, welcome to another episode of Liberty Lens. I am your host, Big John, joined once again on this Wednesday evening by my good friend and co-host, Mr. Mike Termott. Mike, how are you doing tonight?
So good to be with you. We have a minerals deal ourselves, you and I do.
We do. Well, what are we exchanging there? Voluntarily, of course.
We're voluntarily exchanging rights to each other's revenues, which total a grand total of zip. But
makes it easy to split and carry around. Then, Mike,
it's all about sharing.
There you go. Very socialist ideal proffered up here by two libertarians. Okay, so what are we going to talk about today? We said we're going to talk about the U.S.-Ukraine mineral deal. And that's sort of intertwined with peace talks. I think you can't talk about one without talking about the other, Mike. So let me cue this up for you, because you are by far the expert in this subject. So I will just play the quiet host here. Okay, let me tee it up. The U.S.-Ukraine mineral deal was signed on May 1st, so early, less than 10 days ago, establishing a reconstruction investment fund that grants the U.S. preferential access to Ukraine mineral resources in exchange for investment in Ukraine's reconstruction efforts as a result of the ongoing war. This agreement is significant given Ukraine's substantial reserves of critical minerals, including graphite, titanium, and lithium, which are vital for industries like technology, defense, and electric vehicles. So, and this was negotiated between...
And a bunch of other minerals, by the way.
And a bunch of other minerals. Those might be the more, famous or plentiful. Yeah. The deal was signed by Ukraine's economy minister, Yulia Svyrydenko, and U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. So I don't think this is one
AKA
of those...
A.K.A. Scott and Julia.
Scott and Julia. Yulia, yes. Julia, you're absolutely right. Okay. So Mike, let's break this down. There's a lot of confusing terms in this. I hear that it's a private investment fund, but it's at the direction of the U.S. government. Talk to me about this. I'm confused.
Yeah, well, you should be confused. Coming right out of the box, that is just one of the confusing elements. The imprimatur of the governments is critical here. No one is going to invest in the development of Ukrainian minerals, or to be honest, Ukrainian anything else in a long-term sense, unless someone feels like they have A, access to markets, and B, protection.
Right.
This is a war zone. In fact, something like a third of Ukraine's precious resources are on the wrong side of the front line and are under Russian control as we speak. It might be presumed that they will not, in the long run, be a part of the deal, but that remains to be seen. In fact, many of these minerals that we're talking about haven't been mined yet. Right. And the most part, we're talking about the development of brand new mines. As you may know, mining is hugely expensive to develop and takes an enormous period of time before revenues are produced. If you're lucky, you can get something done in a decade. If you're lucky, and there are plenty of examples where certain mining operations take two decades to become profitable, if they become profitable at all. Now, how many people do you know are willing to bet dozens of billions of dollars on the idea that the part of Ukraine that is not now a war zone will never be over the next 20 years?
Right. It's not a good bet, Mike. And one of the things that, as you're talking, sort of came into my head. Okay, so old school Wall Street guys here, let me ask you this. The government's involved. You said they're putting their stamp on it. It's okay. The U.S. is sort of... providing some sense of insurance on this. I know not in the technical sense, but, you know, to say, hey, stature-wise. But in the old days, wouldn't this have been called sovereign risk? That if I as an investor want to go plunk my dollars or whatever, my euros in Ukraine, I'll do that, accept the risk, and demand a higher rate of return. That's why sovereign bonds or junk bonds, right?
Absolutely. In some cases. And, you know, on behalf of my employer, I passed on plenty of sovereign credits when I was in my 20s, and it looked better than this. Okay. This is actually, technically speaking, worse than sovereign credit because at no point is there an expectation. Now, this could change, but right now there is absolutely no expectation that either government is going to guarantee a revenue flow, much less a source of profitability, for any of the private investors. So you could, yeah, you've got the sovereign risk, but you don't have the sovereign backup. In other words, you're not betting on the sovereign's ability to make you whole. You're betting on the sovereign's ability to stay alive.
Well, that is one thing, obviously, right? But you're also counting on the part of the deal that says the U.S. gets first dibs at half of all revenue that's generated as the result of this deal. Yep. And for investing firms on either side of the equation, the Ukrainian or the United States side, tax-free returns.
Tax-free is nice, but you know, if you're in a war zone, the fact that the IRS isn't up your butt is the least of your concerns, I think.
Agreed. So I guess the question I'm posing to you is, this was touted as sort of like a free market solution, and there was great fanfare from the Trump administration saying, hey, this is not going to impact the deficit, the U.S. deficit, one penny. This is all going to be private. It's not going to be done on credit. It's not going to be done on debt, which is very un-Trump-like. So what is the U.S. actually guaranteeing here? Or is that the part of the deal that's best left unmentioned, Mike?
The U.S. is not guaranteeing anything. And it's interesting you brought Trump up. If he were to make a play in mining, right, with the Trump Organization, which he had never done, he would use an enormous amount of debt. He would capitalize whatever company is going to be making the investment completely separately because the chances of it failing are fairly high and you don't want to be on the hook for anything that goes wrong. So, yeah, to your point, would this be classified as junk bonds? At best, right? At best, this is hugely risky and no one is guaranteeing any level of profitability. Among the other risky factors are, yes, whether Ukraine itself will continue as a going concern. And we haven't yet been told what the details financially look like. People confuse the terms revenue with profit. We're really talking about 50% of the profits. A 50% royalty, 50% of revenue would be huge and a great deal for Ukraine, and I don't think that that's what we're talking about here, because we need to leave a lot of incentive on the table for someone to come in and make these investments. So it is confusing at the moment, but in the big picture, I think that what the Ukrainians view as reality, the overarching most important reality, is they are not going to get a security guarantee from the United States. And probably not going to get a security guarantee from anybody else. And so in terms of protecting yourself from further invasion from Russia, this is a pretty thin reed, but this is all you got. The idea that U.S. companies or somebody, right, that the United States cares about, the United States government allows to take advantage of this deal, presumably American companies, are going to be there making big investments. That's the closest thing you're going to get to involving the United States government in a security interest. And that's not that big a deal, right? You can imagine a company comes in and says, you know, we're going to plop down a dozen billion dollars. Right. Well, you know, what's the timing on that? Is that a billion a year for 12 years? Because the United States government might look at that and say, yeah, if that goes south because of a Russian invasion, that might not be worth enough for us to get involved with. right?
Right, right. And Mike, that's, you know, again, with the full acknowledgement that you said this is tricky, complicated, we don't have all the details, there's a lot of stuff here that I think on the face of it sounds, hey, we got a deal, right? Because that seems to be the number one slogan coming out of the Trump administration. When it comes to anything, we got a deal done, right? So given that, but also given a lot of other uncomfortable facts, about a quarter of these rare minerals are in parts of Ukraine slash what will become Russia after any potential peace deal. About a quarter of these rare minerals are in areas where there's landmines scattered all over the place, meaning that the first thing you have to do just to be able to get to them is sweep those things clean. We know that's an inherently super dangerous task.
And therefore expensive.
And expensive. That was going to be my point. The second thing is I still don't understand how this looks like legally or functionally. For example, does a company like BlackRock say, hey, we'll take a huge portion of this. Can we outsource, though, once we get the mining rights, can we outsource it to China? I mean, they do things real cheap, and they already corner the market. Can they outsource
to – And they're good at mining on the cheap.
And they're good at mining on the cheap. Can we outsource it to Russia? You know, it's like these weird little things that I think of. It's like – so
I think it is an open question. And I think it would require the approval of the United States government and the Ukrainian government. Whether those approvals would be granted, I don't know. Probably not next week. Mm. But if this deal, you know, lay dormant for a decade and no one's taking advantage of it, maybe the Chinese could come in themselves directly without a U.S. company. And by that time, the governments will be so desperate for a deal, they'd approve anybody.
Which, if you recall, when we were discussing possibilities of 4 or 5 episodes ago, I mentioned that as a crazy possibility. Why doesn't the Ukraine cut a deal with China for their mineral rights and kind of stick it to both Russia and the U.S. from the Ukrainian point of view?
Right.
One question.
That is an interesting idea. Just to react to that, one of the concerns here is that the Chinese are playing a small role, but a positive role toward Russia in the war. And so from the Ukrainian point of view, there is inherently a conflict of interest. One could imagine the Russians eventually saying, well, there has been no investment there. The United States government does not have an interest in keeping us from taking over the rest of Ukraine. Therefore, we're going to. The only ones who have made an investment might be the Chinese, and we're going to honor that agreement. And the Chinese are going to help us roll, not, you know, we'll do the work to get into Kyiv, but the Chinese are going to help us take the parts of Ukraine that they're interested in for the mining deals. You can imagine from Kyiv's point of view, it could be a huge conflict of interest for them.
Right, right. Do you think there's any possibility that this is some, and again, I'm being super paranoid here, do you think there's any possibility of saying, like, okay, we've got these mining rights. No company in its right mind is going to go in there until, A, the war is over, B, there's some sense of a border, there's some sense of security, which, to your point, may actually never happen, or it may take a decade or two for it to happen. Do you think this is the type of thing that this agreement is in place, no sane company goes in there, so then the U.S. government says, well, we got this deal. Why don't we send in our government contractors, our armed forces, to secure these minerals? Do you think this is a backdoor to that type of involvement, which for libertarians who are currently cheering like this free market solution, could it turn sour on us? Could it turn sour?
It starts looking a lot like colonialism.
Right.
Yes, I think that it is a possibility. I don't even know if I would call that necessarily a backdoor. One could imagine in relatively short, or one could imagine by the end of the year, the Trump administration saying, no, 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 that's the front door. You know, that is the plan, is we send in troops, we keep the peace, we make sure that we have the development of these mineral rights that we want. I think the Ukrainians on some level would welcome that.
Sure. If it's boots on the ground, I would assume they would.
If it's boots on the ground, I think the ones that would really be irritated would be the Russians.
So as we discuss this potential deal here, and again, this was a cornerstone even when Zelensky was in Washington and that, you know, that infamous photo op disaster with Trump and with Vance, that, you know, Trump emerged from this like, hey, a condition's got to be that we got to get something out of this. We're going to get a good mineral deal out of this. That's what they're now touting that they've accomplished, right? So this is one of those, this is what we voted for PR pieces, right?
Yeah.
But let me pose this to you. Is it really what was promised a month or two ago with Zelensky in Washington, i.e. to the Trump base?
No, it's not. In the sense that Trump had said what he wants is a revenue stream to the federal government. And that is not part of this deal. Zelensky did a good job, in my view, standing up against that. And I think that he will reap political benefit from that. But whether that means that he gets a security benefit from that is yet to be demonstrated. I had felt, and we talked about that some time ago, I had felt that Zelensky should have taken this deal a lot earlier. But he believed that he could get a security agreement, and that's what they were bickering about, in which J.D. Vance jumped in. I think that, you know, everyone in that room played it badly. You know, sometimes I tend to be a little bit critical of the president, but I got to say, and this is a weird thing to say out loud, of the three of them, he was the most disciplined.
You know,
Zelensky was the one who shot his mouth off. You're right. It was a photo op, not a mouth op.
Right.
And if he had a problem with, hey, I need a security guarantee and I need to say this 11 different ways 15 times, then, you know, you do that before embarrassing the president and the vice president on the couch. Right.
Agreed.
And Vance needs to be more disciplined, too. I get why he was pissed. I don't disagree with that. But that did not come off looking well the way he voiced his dissatisfaction with Zelensky. I think Zelensky should have recognized earlier. Sometimes, you know, we say all the time that Trump is getting bad staff work. I think Zelensky got bad staff work. Someone should have told him earlier, we're not getting the security guarantee.
Right.
You know, let's ask for an enhanced version of the mineral deal, a more robust version where we're not giving up money, but it comes with a few American troops on the ground somehow, right? That's what we want to be negotiating for. And they didn't do that. You know, they rejected the minerals deal because it felt too much like colonialism. Trump was asking for a revenue stream. Zelensky didn't want to give it to him. I agree. He shouldn't have given it to him because that really would have looked like colonialism and would not have been the right deal for the White House. I don't know if they recognize that at the moment, but that would have been a bad look for the United States in the long run. So I really think that Zelensky, you know, blew that at the time. He's lucky to be getting back to where we are today because that could have gone much worse for him than it did.
Agreed. So if you were to give this an overall rating, would you say this was a good deal from the U.S. perspective? And was it a good deal if you're looking at it from a libertarian lens?
I think that it's a great deal for both sides because it's a big nothing burger when both sides needed a little bit of a nothing burger. You know, the White House needs to have some sort of a deal. They need to be building a relationship there and to look like they're extracting some value and not taking the same approach as the Biden administration. They didn't promise more taxpayer money to Ukraine. So these are all wins, either from the PR point of view of the White House or the libertarian point of view. I don't think it's important from the United States point of view. From the Ukrainian point of view, it is still a nothing burger, but a real good one when they needed a real good nothing burger, right? They need to start building this relationship. This is the one thing that Zelensky gets wrong. He needs a tighter relationship. When, you know, everyone's upset about the relationship between Trump and Putin, right? even though it has not yet been demonstrated that Trump is going to capitulate, that's what we're worried about, that has right. not yet come to pass, but people are nonetheless upset about them having a working relationship. Well, that's relative to the relationship between Trump and Zelensky. And whose fault is that? I get that Trump is pushing him and doesn't want to give him any more money, so Zelensky should be pissed. I get that. But you've got to work at the relationship in reality and in imagery, which is very, very important to any democratically right. elected administration, and no less so for this one, as we know. So he needs to, you know, he needs to play that sport a little bit more in a sophisticated fashion than he has been.
Right, right. Yeah, Zelensky does seem to have just one playbook when it comes to PR and one playbook when it comes to how people perceive him.
And in fairness, his country is at war, having been invaded due to not much fault of his own. And so I get why you would only have a fairly narrow – I get that, right? I mean, right, you got to right. cut the guy some slack. But his staff needs to step up and protect him from making some of these bad decisions. But they have righted the ship. They got the deal. And I think that one of the things that we need to talk about is where the negotiation is going between – Ukraine and Russia,
right?
But among Ukraine, Russia, and the United States, and possibly Europe, they don't seem to be playing a major role at the moment. That's a problem for Ukraine, in my view. But I think it's important for us to remember that Putin is unlikely to view this deal as all that important. I think the Ukrainians want Putin to consider that deal important, but without American boots on the ground, without American companies already executing a deal, even with the long-term nature of the development of these mineral rights, I don't know that Putin is going to be intimidated by, ooh, you know, I better back off and cut my own deal and end this conflict because of what? American companies pouring a few billion dollars in there over the next two decades, that doesn't strike me as enough to put that guy off.
No, I mean, he wouldn't care at all about American investment in terms of dollars in there. But I think what might cause him a little bit of pause is, hey, there's American contractors in there, there's American civilians in there, and that in that case, you can't just willy-nilly start lobbing missiles into Ukraine because right. you don't want to put American lives at risk, because then that will elicit a response. So I think up until the point where that this deal actually matures into, you know, infrastructure, you know, physical U.S. presence in the Ukraine, I agree with you. I don't think Putin could be bothered.
I think you're right. In fact, I would have recommended to Zelensky that part of the deal should include an agreement that the United States put 1,000 American citizens there one way or another. I don't care whether they're surveyors, geologists, troops, engineers, right. bankers, or just farmers to watch the land until somebody does something with it.
Right.
But I need, you know, American humans on the ground here, lickety split, and he ain't getting that. So right. That's a real problem for him.
Yeah, that would have been his insurance policy, a very cheap insurance policy. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, as we transition from the deal, the other thing that goes hand in hand with this, to some extent, is going to be the ongoing peace talks between Russia and the Ukraine. And as of this episode, the peace talks between Russia and Ukraine are ongoing. They're being facilitated by the United States under President Trump. Excuse me. With Saudi Arabia emerging as the primary host country for these negotiations.
Yep.
Talks have seen various proposals and counterproposals, but no final agreement has been reached, reflecting the complexity and sensitivity of the issue. So what are we talking about here? And look, I think to say first off, the idea that Ukraine is going to remain the same size as it was prior to this war, I think we've given up all hope of that. And I think hopefully Zelensky has given up any hope of that. They're going to settle the lines like most wars when they end. When the agreement is signed, that's the new borders, right? It'll be wherever, as far as you've advanced, as far as you've retreated, whatever, right? But talk to me, how do you see these talks from an ongoing perspective? Do you think there's progress being made? Is this still a hang-up? Is the issue of European security involved in this? What's going on, Mike?
Well, I think you're right. I think let's go to 30,000 feet and then come back in. Yeah.
You got it.
The 30,000-foot level, of course, is that Zelensky is upset about the loss of territory, and he should be, right? He also needs the war to come to an end, and so that's the negotiation that goes on in his mind. To a certain extent, Ukraine is negotiating with themselves because they have got to figure out how to bring this to a close, how to make sure that it doesn't continue in one form or another. Is there a way to recoup some of their losses in terms of real estate? Yes, I can only imagine what they're thinking about the 1994 agreement to give away their nuclear armaments, right? I can just imagine. And a lot of that is going to leverage the concept of, well, you can't trust the Americans and you can't trust the Russians. Okay, so you can't, we were okay, we gave up our nuclear weapons, and we didn't get the security guarantee, but we had an implication, and it turns out that you can't trust the Americans and you can't trust the Russians. So let's cut a deal in which we have to trust the Americans and the Russians. This is not a good position for Ukraine to be stuck in.
Sure,
right?
Absolutely.
This is a very, very bad spot. I think it also needs to be pointed out, and J.D. Vance has pointed this out publicly, Ukraine is in a tough spot resource-wise, both in terms of human resources and financial resources and their ability to maintain production of armament. The Europeans can help. The Americans can help. But both of those sources are going to run fairly attenuated real quick if there's no agreement in place, because to your point, people are getting pessimistic.
Yeah.
That's the Ukrainian view, right? And they're battling an existential fight. The Russians from 30,000 feet do not believe that Ukraine has a right to exist. Certainly not by the standards of Russian interests. Even to the extent to which Putin might say, yeah, I get your argument that Ukraine, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda, be a separate country, that pales in comparison to how I feel about Russian imperialism. There has been significant talk over the past few years of the extent to which Putin has been influenced by this guy who, you know, a lot of people in the United States sarcastically call him Putin's brain, which is to say this guy, Dugin, right, who is a philosopher and an author. And he's been at this for 30 years trying to influence the Russian government and has done so with a great deal of success. Much of what he says in writing comes out in words from Putin's mouth. This guy is explicitly, and this is going to be hard for a lot of our libertarians to hear, explicitly anti-enlightenment. Let that sink in. We tend to think of the Enlightenment as given, right? Not just because, you know, John Locke is our hero, Adam Smith is our hero, both of which are true. But we tend to think it's sort of like the Industrial Revolution. Nobody backs up on that and decides, you know, let's start farming with oxen instead of tractors now. That's not a thing that happens. Well, it is a thing that happens in the Kremlin when it comes to the philosophy behind their imperialistic ambitions.
I'm sorry, Mike, for a split second here, just back up. Talk to me about this Dugin very quickly. Let us know who he is and why he has this influence over Putin.
Long-term author, used to work in the government when he started out, former agent, just like Putin. His family was involved with the government. He has is a fascist. He has said in the deep dark past favorable things toward the Nazi regime, for example. Not only is he anti-enlightenment, but he's not what you would call a communist. He does not believe that the reason we do all these things is to spread communism. You know, this is not Lenin we're talking about. Right. This is a guy who believes in Russian imperialism as a matter of the way the world has worked the past several hundred years, and the way the world is going to develop for the next several hundred years. He believes that Ukraine will be part of Russia, that all those countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union will once again be part of Greater Russia, because that's the way that it should be, and it's a matter of standing up against the United States and the West, Western Europe, because those countries are evil, that their form of government, their form of culture are just not the way that humanity should go. These are huge, broad, sweeping concepts that Putin has bought into.
So it's a lot, and I'm not trying to be flippant, but it does sound like, even if there's a difference in degree, it does sound a lot like the MAGA sort of approach to things, right? Very nationalistic. There's, like, I mean, there is a view of American hegemony from a lot of MAGA. You could say that maybe from this Dugin perspective, there's Russian nationalism with Russian hegemony that's saying, like, hey, we deserve to be at the head of the table, and we want to ensure that Russia stays at the head of the table. And
yeah.
It's interesting. I haven't heard of this before, but
reminds me slightly more of the neocons who spent so much time selling us American exceptionalism.
There you go. Yeah.
And the idea that the United States not only is the hegemon, but should be.
Right.
Because we're better than everybody else, because we're better than everybody else, because we said so.
The West is best, baby. Didn't you know that?
West is best. And, you know, New World Order, right?
Right.
George Herbert
right.
Walker Bush, who a lot of folks thought had a lighter touch than some other American leaders, but he was all about a New World Order and us being in charge, and everyone else ought to behave. So it's not completely different from that. You know, the MAGA folks, the Trump folks, at least to their credit, they're not all about, well, we're nationalists and therefore we're going to invade everybody else. Right? Those are dots that they don't connect, and good for them, right? It's one thing to be a nationalist and to be skeptical about international institutions and about, you know, an uncontrolled border. That's one thing. But to play that out in terms of violent imperialism and taking over your neighbors, that's a different kettle of fish. And that's what the Kremlin is all about these days. And they are willing to play a long game. I think that the difference between the long game the Chinese play and the long game that the Russians play is that the Russians feel like they need to get this done in Putin's lifetime. Whereas the PRC, I think, you know, if they had to, in their 5-year plan is taking over Taiwan, if they had to wait a longer period of time, I could imagine them, you know, learning some patience because they know where they're going in the long run. On the other hand, Putin, I think, has got to feel his biological clock ticking, and he wants to be in charge of restoring Russia to its greatness, its imperialistic nature. And that is not a communist play. This is not so that we can spread communism around the world. This is just flat out Russia's better.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. So if it's this mindset that you're fighting, and if you're the United States, hopefully you're aware of this mindset, how are you trying to navigate, how are you trying to steer Zelensky and Putin through the peace process then? Is it by capitulation for the most part? Because, you know, hey, they're really not that big, the Ukraine. So what do we care if Russia annexes Ukraine?
It's very difficult. In fact, it was Dugin's idea that he sold to Putin. If you can't take over Ukraine all in one step, you know, going back 10 years ago, let's gobble it up in pieces and take our time. And that appears to be the strategy that they have been pursuing. And so it suggests that if it takes another decade, maybe that's okay with the Russians in the long run. So assuming that Zelensky is aware of the long-term game the Russians are willing to play, he needs security guarantees. He needs someone to help him protect Ukrainian sovereignty because he doesn't have the resources to do it on his own. In other words, knowing that you can't trust the Russians, and I'm sure he feels you can't trust the Americans either, knowing that attitude, having that history, that means you can't just cut a deal, expect the Russians to adhere to it, and say, okay, now we can start rebuilding our country. Everything is going to be fine. That is abject silliness.
Well, then how so if you're Zelensky now, right, and if you're looking at the United States saying, let's broker this, you know, okay, let them keep whatever they've taken, meaning let Russia keep whatever they've taken in this round. But another key part of this is that the Russian insistence that Ukraine not join NATO.
Bingo.
But it would seem to me that that's really the only ace left up Zelensky's sleeve. Like, okay, I'm not getting the arms I need. I'm not getting the tactical support I need. I'm not getting the strategic support I need. At least let me join NATO.
In fact, many have argued, possibly correctly, that it was Zelensky's movement, his predecessor's movement toward the European Union, that made Putin feel that the next shoe to drop would be NATO membership, and that he could not tolerate because the long-term plan was to take it over.
Right.
So they are in a bit of a pickle, but it's a yin and a yang. You can't walk away with no security guarantee. If you get a security guarantee, that's going to piss off the Russians all the more. You need a negotiating partner who's willing to piss off the Russians. You need someone, whether it's NATO, whether it's a collection of NATO members from Western Europe, whether it's the United States, maybe it's without the United States, but you need someone to say, here's a pile of resources, here's what we're going to do if this happens, and frankly, there's no guarantee like boots on the ground. To your earlier point, this is what it is that Zelensky needs to be negotiating for. Otherwise, I would predict we're not going to get an explicit deal. At best, we're going to get a Korea-style standoff where there is a demilitarized zone. There's a line drawn in the sand. People don't cross it, not because they necessarily have agreed never to cross it. They just don't feel like it at the moment. The difference is that in South Korea, anyone who crosses that line from North Korea is going to face Americans and Europeans, right? If Zelensky doesn't have that on his side of the border, you can almost guarantee that the Russians will eventually take more land.
That's the unfortunate reality. So if you're the United States, and you're involved and you're leading these peace talks, right? Like, let's face it, we're the
ringmaster.
We're the referee. We're the ringmaster of this circus. So what is our play here? Do we just throw up our hands, or is it that we get American companies in there as sort of a security, not a real security guarantee, but some sort of security guarantee? Clearly, it's not going to be Trump pulling Putin aside and talking to him. That's not going to work. So where do you see this? What should the U.S. be doing here?
I think that the United States probably will end up walking away. I think that they will probably, the White House will probably get a deal cut, or at least an armistice, a standoff. and walk away, being able to claim some sort of victory politically. But over time, whether that's as soon as Trump leaves the White House or triggered by some other event, over time, I believe that that agreement or de facto understanding will eventually be overcome by the long-term logic of Moscow's interest in taking over Ukraine in bites, if not all in one piece. I just think that that's probably where this is going. The citizens of the United States are not all that interested in giving them another couple of $100 billion, and they're not interested in putting troops over there. So there you have it. And I think that Putin knows this. I think that he is going to outweigh the process. I don't think that he has any incentive whatsoever to sign an agreement. The longer this goes on, the better his chances are of either wearing down his opponent or waiting until the time is better and just making a play that's right for him. And remember that the Russians have had a tremendous loss in this war, both in terms of personnel and in terms of resources. So if he had to slow it down, from his point of view, that's not necessarily a bad strategy.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I would tend to think that both from a political perspective and from our, I would say, personal beliefs, like the U.S. should withdraw from there entirely. And since we have no meaningful role to play as a peace negotiator here, we should step out of that role too. And really, the ones who should be stepping up, to me, seems to be the Europeans, that they could provide a security guarantee to Ukraine if they were willing to step up.
And, agreed.
And they need to be at the head of that table. Now, whether they could or not,
they should be at the head of that table, possibly with the United States playing a minor role, possibly not. You don't want it to, you know, rhyme with NATO and all of a sudden you're back in the soup. A lot of this, John, I think, points out that it was not a good idea for the United States to have given all those resources to Ukraine in the first place.
Agreed.
Because now our exodus makes it look like our failure. And that's a problem both in imagery, which is not completely unimportant. You know, puts the White House in an awkward situation. It could have put any administration in an awkward situation, right? Imagine if President Biden had won re-election. Possible, right? Imagine if that had happened. And now we're in the pickle where it says Vietnam. You know, right. You can't just walk away. You're going to have to spend hundreds of billions here and hundreds of billions there, right, and keep it going, because otherwise the size of the defeat becomes significantly in a real political albatross. So in that sense, the American taxpayer, just from a financial point of view, is lucky that, in my view, that Biden didn't win re-election. And, of course, Trump was clear on that from the beginning. So he's, in effect, playing out what he had signaled that he would do. So things would have been better, not just as a matter of imagery, but, you know, in terms of sending a signal to Russia. I believe how much better might it have been if we hadn't given over a couple of $100 billion in the beginning, right, but threatened to do so now? What if the Ukrainians were able to slow the initial offensive, which they were, and at some point, we let it go for a while, let it go, and said, now we decide this is over. And this is what we're willing to do about it. Maybe you have had to have come up with those resources, maybe not. But your leverage and prestige at that point are significantly more than they are now, where you feel like you're backed into the same corner as Zelensky is.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I really do think that getting this phantom, at this moment, this phantom minerals deal might provide the Trump administration an out to say, okay, we got our deal, art of the deal, everyone go read that book. You can see this is what we mean by that. That's what the president does best. We're out of here. good luck to Volodymyr, good luck to Vladimir, and we're out, you know, like the blackjack dealer, we're out, you know, we're gone for this shift, you know, and then just hope for the best for the Ukrainians in that situation, Mike. All right. This has been an interesting talk. At least you've caught me up on what's going on. Now I feel a little bit more well-equipped to discuss this, Mike, and for that, I thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I do think that your quick summary there at the end is absolutely on point. I think that that's probably how this is going to play out. And in the long run, I worry about the sovereignty of Ukraine very much.
Yeah, I think it's almost not looking too good for them. But we'll see what happens in the future. Hopefully it will turn out a little bit brighter for them. All right, everyone, you've been watching Liberty Lens right here on Grumblings Media. Check us out at grumblingsmedia.com, where you can find our past episodes of Liberty Lens with me and Mike Termott. You can also check out Free for All, our libertarian talk show, streaming live every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, plus other great content that's coming out of this company. So check us out at grumblingsmedia.com and on all your favorite social platforms. Until next week when we do this again, for Mike Termott, this is Big John. Peace, everyone.